The economy created almost 250,000 jobs last month.
And the unemployment rate dips to a three-year low.
From APM, American Public Media in Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Adrienne Hill. You're listening to the Midday Update from Marketplace.org. It's Friday, February 3rd.
Coming up, the latest on this morning's stellar jobs report.
The UK declares a war on straws.
And the economic impact of the Super Bowl on everything from cities to the makers of buffalo wings.
Those stories and more just ahead on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune in to Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
Now let's get to the January jobs report, which came in this morning from the Labor Department. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer joins us from Washington with the details. Nancy, give us the headlines.
Hey, Jeremy, this is a really good jobs report, better than a lot of people expected. The unemployment rate has dropped to 8.3%. 243,000 jobs were created, 50,000 of them in manufacturing, which, of course, has been a bright spot for the recovery over the past year. December and November jobs were revised upward. But one thing we really have to remember, Jeremy, there are still 5.5 million people who are long-term unemployed. That is, they have been looking for work for 27 weeks or more.
Indeed. Even with the good news that comes in, we are climbing out of a very deep hole. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer in Washington. And let's get a reaction now from our regular Friday guest, Chris Lowe. He is chief economist with FTN Financial, and he's with us live from New York. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning, Jeremy.
Well, give us your reaction. What do you make of this report?
Nancy said it's a really terrific report. What we like to see as economists is not just a good headline number, but decent details to back it up, and that's what we got. Widespread job gains, 50,000 in manufacturing, 21,000 in construction. Private payrolls up big, too. The only standout job losses here, government trimming 14,000 jobs. But to post a big headline rise like we did despite that is terrific.
And Chris, I noticed another thing in this report, which is that the unemployment rate did not really change for women, but it did come down for men. What does that tell you?
Well, that's right. And that's because the two really hard-hit areas in the recession, which were construction and manufacturing, both did quite well this time. Those are male-dominated industries. The male unemployment rate went up a lot more in the recession than the female unemployment rate. So we expect it would come down faster. That's actually been one that's lagging. So it's a good sign.
And quickly, Chris, any chance that this is just a momentary piece of good news that we'll head right back down again?
Well, it could be. You know, last year we had a string of decent reports early in the year, and then high gas prices sort of snuffed out the economy. I think it'll be different this time, though, because consumers overseas are likely to buckle under high gas prices before we have to worry about it here in the U.S.
Chris Lowe, chief economist with FTN Financial. Thanks as always.
Thank you.
For another take on this, we turn to David Weiss. He's a visiting fellow at Brown University. Good morning.
Good morning.
So what strikes you about these numbers?
Obviously, they're very strong. It's hard to find much sign of weakness in here. Basically, everybody's hiring except the government. And although the population change in January caused by the revision in census estimates does distort some of the household numbers, even you take that out, it looks awfully strong.
Now, is there anything in these numbers that does concern you or that raises a little flag?
Frankly, no.
Wow.
I think the only interesting thing is a lot of the population change on the re-estimate was concentrated among women, and particularly non-white women, which is sort of odd. Apparently, we've been undercounting them. If anything, though, that gives you a little bit of a boost in the unemployment rate, or should have. The other point, the biggest drop here was in the unemployment rate was among non-whites who had been lagging. So maybe they're catching up.
Now, does this mean that 2012 is going to be the year we see a strong recovery?
A strong recovery is probably an exaggeration, but stronger probably is true. We are seeing a little more strength in the economy. People are feeling confident enough to spend. They're feeling confident enough to to go out there and do something instead of just huddled around the television set.
Now, are there sectors you expect to see more growth in going forward?
Oh, certainly. Number one, healthcare continues to be a dominant sector. We're getting older. As you get older, you get sicker. And unfortunately, that's probably going to continue to be a strong sector. Construction, we had a 21,000 gain here. We're starting to see a stabilization in that sector, distorted somewhat by the mild winter weather. But still, that's a very encouraging sign as well.
David Weiss is a visiting fellow at Brown University. Thanks.
Thank you.
Now, for the White House's take on these job numbers, we have Alan Krueger. He's the chairman of President Obama's Council of Economic Advisors. Good morning.
Good morning.
So what strikes you about these numbers?
I say every month that you need to look at the jobs report in the context of other information that's coming in. I think we see a picture of a job market that is healing, that's recovering from the trauma that was inflicted by the recession that began back at the end of 2007. And it's extremely important that we take the steps to keep up this momentum, such as by extending the two percentage point payroll tax reduction, as well as extending unemployment benefits for the rest of 2012.
Now, what were you surprised by in today's report?
Well, I think what the report indicates is that the job growth was pretty broad-based. It was spread over a number of industries. And this recovery has been unique because of the nature of the crisis in the first place. Most recoveries are fueled by very strong growth in home building, residential construction. But because we overbuilt so many houses earlier in the 2000s, construction has been very weak. We did see growth in construction jobs. We saw 50,000 manufacturing jobs. So we're seeing that the steps that were taken to continue the recovery, to dig our way out of this deep hole, have been working, and I think that's encouraging.
Now, as you just mentioned, jobs were added in manufacturing, construction, some retail jobs. But are these the kind of jobs that we want for the economy that we want?
Well, the president emphasized in his State of the Union a blueprint for building an America that's stronger, for an economy that's built to last. And that is based on a stronger manufacturing sector, American energy, increasing the skills of the workforce, as well as a return to American values of fairness. And last month, we saw 50,000 new manufacturing jobs added. The president has a strategy for strengthening manufacturing. Manufacturing tends to provide employment for particularly good jobs for less skilled workers, helping them to get into the middle class.
Now, an 8.3% unemployment rate is better than we've seen in a while, but there are a lot of people out there who just aren't looking for work anymore and aren't counted. What do you say to them?
I think what's particularly important is that we keep up the momentum creating more jobs that will strengthen the economy. We need also to increase the skills of the American workforce. I think the key variable here is job growth. The drop in the unemployment rate last month was entirely a result of faster job growth, not from a drop in people participating in the labor force. We just need to keep up that momentum of quicker job growth to provide more opportunities for American workers.
Alan Krueger is the chairman of the White House Council of Economic Advisors. Thanks.
Thank you very much.
Tomorrow, Nevada Republicans will voice their opinion on which presidential candidate should face President Obama in the election this fall. And the issue of housing is likely to be front and center on voters' minds. Nevada led the nation in foreclosures last year. And so it is where we launch coverage from our new Wealth and Poverty Desk. Here's Marketplace's Sarah Gardner.
Meet Tom Wedeen, husband, father of three, and hurting homeowner.
This is our cul-de-sac. I call it Foreclosure Lane.
With Dean, his wife Denise, and their daughters live in Enterprise, a middle-class suburb just south of Las Vegas. Their street isn't even a decade old yet, but it's seen plenty of trouble.
There's 11 houses on it. 9 have been foreclosed, 2 of them foreclosed twice.
With Dean fears his house will be next. The couple used to run a small business fixing properties damaged by fire or burst water pipes. But since losing that business during the housing bust, the Wedeens have struggled to make payments on their four-bedroom home.
It was about a year that we started having to use credit cards to survive.
In fact, Denise says, they haven't made a payment in months.
So I guess we're just kind of waiting for that sticker on our door right now. I do look every day.
Like many Nevada homeowners, the Wedeens are stuck. Their house is worth a mere third of their $450,000 mortgage. They can't make any money selling the house, and even if they could sell and move, the job market isn't that promising elsewhere. Tom says, funny thing is, when times were good, their suburban street attracted some riffraff.
Well, I think because drug dealers could buy houses for no money down.
Since all the foreclosures, though, the Wedeens say decent families have moved in. They're hoping a new state law that makes it harder for banks to foreclose will buy them some time. Tom's busy hunting for a new career, and the family just filed for personal bankruptcy to get out from under some old business debt.
It's a new road for us to travel on. I wish we weren't there. But it basically is going to give us a fresh start, and you know that's what we need. I'm 47. I don't have too much time to get another start going and be able to generate an income.
One saving grace, Wedeen says, Denise's part-time job at Starbucks. It doesn't begin to pay the bills, but it's the only reason they have health insurance. In Enterprise, Nevada, I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
And Kai Rizdahl will be hosting a special broadcast from Las Vegas today on Marketplace.
Well, states have until Monday to decide if they want to join a national settlement with banks over abusive mortgage practices. The deal could be worth up to $25 billion, but not every state wants in. Marketplace's Jeff Tyler reports.
What's better, take the banks to court and risk years of litigation, or cut a deal and move forward? Keith Dubanovich is chief of staff for Oregon's attorney general.
The fact that we can now provide some direct benefit to people that are facing foreclosure this year as opposed to sometime down the road is one of the substantial reasons that we felt that this was a benefit to Oregon and we wanted to sign on.
Under the deal, banks would modify loans. That could be worth as much as $200 million for Oregon homeowners. The dollar amounts vary from state to state. The reforms are more universal. Kathleen Day is with the Center for Responsible Lending.
So it would end the so-called robo-signing, where employees were just signing things, attesting to things in a court of law that they had no idea about. That's just fraud, and banks won't be able to do it.
Day says the settlement isn't perfect, but it helps people keep their homes. She says that's important because research shows we're only halfway through the total number of expected foreclosures. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
Marketplace covers the world of economics. Are you ready for some Freakonomics? We're partnering with the team that writes about the hidden side of everything for a regular Marketplace Freakonomics story, podcast, and more. Just go to freakonomicsradio.com.
Now to the Marketplace global perspective. Chinese leaders say they'll consider doing more to help resolve the European debt crisis. But when it comes to how much to help, China is treading very carefully. Marketplace China Bureau Chief Rob Schmitz reports.
Premier Wen Jiabao says China wants to help solve the EU debt crisis, but how much money China will contribute is anybody's guess.
I think it'll be significant, but it won't put China in the position of being a savior of the EU.
William Hess is director of PRC Macro Advisors in Beijing. Hess says China's trying to figure out the magic amount it'll take to gain political favors from the EU in return, favors like easing trade restrictions and curbing WTO complaints against China. Hess says Beijing is in a tough position.
Big spending to bail out welfare states in Europe when China's social safety net is still pretty weak, it doesn't look very good.
It's not looking good to Shen Ying, a 30-year-old delivery man in Shanghai.
This is the people's money, and they're wasting it. If we give the Europeans money, this will improve their goods and resources. Then we'll have to buy those goods at higher prices. In the end, all the money ends up in the hands of the foreigners.
And for Shen and for millions of other Chinese, that doesn't seem fair. In Shanghai, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
Now to London, where restaurants and bars have declared war on the straw, as in the plastic straws that come with drinks. Marketplace's Stephen Beard joins us now to explain. Good morning, Stephen.
Good morning, Jeremy.
So explain this war on the straws.
Well, these bars and restaurants in Soho in London are not banning plastic straws. They're just not handing them out automatically anymore. Customers will have to ask for a straw in future, so that'll probably reduce the number that are handed over.
And why is this happening?
for environmental reasons. Conservationists say most of these straws, especially from fast food outlets, are thrown on the sidewalk. They end up in the gutter, in the drains, and eventually the sea, where they damage marine wildlife and pollute the beaches.
Now, I have to say, I'm not really a straw guy myself, but what's the reaction been over there?
Well, so far, customers seem to be reacting positively. These two Coke drinkers who were strawless in London yesterday were not complaining.
It'll be all right. I'll just drink it out of a cup. Straws aren't a big deal.
I don't mind about the straws because I'm going to drink without it anyway, so...
But, you know, I should say, Jeremy, this campaign is not, I suspect, going to have a major impact on the UK. Beer and tea are still the two key beverages here, and no one in their right mind would use a straw to drink either of
don't
them.
Don't need a straw for those. Marketplace's Stephen Beard in London. Thanks, Stephen.
Okay, Jeremy.
Well, now to a supermarket in the UK called Sainsbury's, which sold a product called Tiger Bread. The crust of the bread looks sort of like the side of a tiger. Well, actually, as a three-year-old girl named Lily Robinson wrote in a letter to Sainsbury's, it should be called giraffe bread because it looks more like a giraffe.
Do you think she's right, having looked at the bread?
I think she's probably right. It does look like a giraffe, although, you know, it also kind of looks like a leopard. Maybe you could call it leopard bread. But anyway, Sainsbury's agreed with little Lily, little three-year-old Lily.
Way to go.
And now, all across the UK, you can buy giraffe bread.
Nice job, Lily. About 150,000 football fans are expected in Indianapolis for the Super Bowl, and a lot of those visitors will have deep pockets. By some estimates, they'll spend $150 million. It's a nice short-term boost, but city officials are hoping the game could have a longer-lasting economic impact. From Station WBOI in Indiana, Sean Beter has our story.
It's a quiet afternoon at The Place, a restaurant and bar on the north side of Indianapolis. In fact, it's a little too quiet when you consider football fans are already mobbing the city's attractions and jamming up downtown traffic. General Manager Bill McCammon hopes the big boost will come this weekend.
I would say that, you know, if we see anything in the number in the midst of 15 to 20% increase in population in here, that would be a pretty good sizable bump for a Super Bowl.
The place has only been open a few months and is still settling into the community, so this weekend's business will help. But Indianapolis Mayor Greg Ballard is dreaming bigger. Ballard says this is a once-in-a-lifetime chance to bring long-term growth to the city because 65% of Super Bowl attendees are decision-makers in their businesses.
So when they're looking at expanding their businesses or bringing conventions to town or something like that, Indianapolis will now have a bigger name across the world as a result of the Super Bowl.
Companies make those kind of decisions for a lot more reasons than, boy, it's nice to have walked around here and spent 3 days here.
That's Indiana University economist Kyle Anderson. He says when he looks at previous Super Bowls, it's tough to tell if host cities have seen any long-term economic growth.
Nobody's gone out and said, well, Detroit hosted the Super Bowl a couple of years ago, and suddenly they got, you know, four big corporations moving to the Detroit area. That's never really been tracked that way.
For his part, Bill McCammon at The Place says he's optimistic about this weekend. He expects a lot of customers trying out his restaurant will be locals who don't want the hassle of dining downtown near the Super Bowl Village. And with a little luck, some of those first-timers might just turn into regulars. In Indianapolis, I'm Sean Beter for Marketplace.
So, Adrian, of course, if you've ever been to a big sporting event like the Super Bowl, you know there are a lot of people outside the arenas selling cheap shirts and other merchandise with your favorite team or band logo on it.
You know, I was at the Prince concert recently when Prince was performing in L.A., and there were tons of these, like, $5 Prince shirts.
Of course, a great way to make some money, although sometimes these off-market shirts are not quite as high quality, and often they are not legal either. Well, yesterday, authorities from the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement showed that they are cracking down on this kind of illegal activity, seizing around $5 million worth of counterfeit NFL merchandise.
In today's Midday Extra, we look at Operation Fake Sweep. And here to talk with us is George Espinosa. He's an intellectual property lawyer in Miami with experience in anti-counterfeiting. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Well, thanks. So in the grand scheme of the gray market, is this seizure a big deal?
Well, the seizure is a big deal for publicity. The NFL and other content providers need to get the message out there that they're not going to sit back and allow their content to be counterfeited or streamed online. So for purposes of publicity, it's a very big deal. In the overall scheme of dollars and cents, $5 million is just a small change in the counterfeiting business.
And does it have an effect? Do counterfeiters stop doing what they're doing when a big seizure like this happens?
Our experience has always been that they'll stop for a while. But as long as there's profit to be made, somebody's going to be willing to take a risk somewhere down the line. So when you see a raid like the ones that you've seen in the last few days and operations that put people in jail, it's really got to be part of an ongoing, continuous campaign. If it isn't, the value dissipates over the months and years.
Now, does the demand for these shirts sort of a sign that all this NFL gear is too expensive?
Well, you know, you have to be careful when we say too expensive. The bottom line is that a trademark owner has the right to sell his copyrighted or trademark content at the price that he wishes to sell it, and the consumer can choose to buy it or not to buy it. If the fact that something was expensive was sufficient reason to justify its being copied or stolen, my wife would have had to hope diamond many years ago. The reality is that, yes, the fact that these goods are expensive makes it more tempting for counterfeiters to counterfeit it because they're going to make more money by counterfeiting it. It certainly doesn't justify the counterfeiting.
Now, you say it has a temporary effect usually when this happens, but I imagine we'll still probably be able to get some counterfeit Super Bowl gear if we really want to over the weekend.
You know, there is always somebody out there willing to take the chance, but that doesn't mean that the authorities have given up, and it doesn't mean that the guy that's selling you something isn't part of a sting operation. So I would certainly advise against buying the counterfeit stuff if you can avoid it.
Hey, George, let me ask you one more thing, which is you're in Miami. Who are the people in Miami rooting for? Or do they care about this Super Bowl between New York and New England this year?
Well, I think a lot of people in Miami care. We have a lot of transplanted New Yorkers. We've also got a lot of Patriot fans. And a long time ago, I learned that a smart lawyer knows when not to express an opinion. So I'm going to cheer for both.
Well, and sorry about the Dolphins.
So am I.
George Espinosa is an intellectual property lawyer. He was joining us from Miami. George, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
And finally, Jeremy, Super Bowl is about football, sure. And it's about the ads, definitely. That's what I'm going to be watching this weekend.
You're watching for all the ads. Well, I want to see these Ferris Bueller commercials that have been out there.
I'm looking, yeah, I get into the ads. But Super Bowl is also about eating. And the highlight of mini spreads will be fried, spicy, juicy chicken wings.
Yeah.
Bloomberg reports wing prices are at an all-time high. Wholesale prices in Georgia, which is the largest chicken state, are up 52%.
Wow.
But that does not seem to be getting between us and all that buffalo-y goodness. The National Chicken Council says Americans will eat 1.25 billion chicken wings
wow.
during the Super Bowl. That's enough wings to circle the earth twice, Jeremy. And do you want to guess? Guess the calorie count?
Ooh, that well, if it's 1.25 billion, I'm going to say it's, what is it, a trillion calories?
100 billion very tasty
calories.
Oh,
that's low fat. There you go. That's not bad. And I want some buffalo wings right now. In Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Adrienne Hill. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
This is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.